The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Emerging markets are where the growth is. No, wait. Emerging markets are being hit by US interest rates and a trade war. Can both be true? How do you separate emerging market wheat from chaff? Welcome to Benchmark. I'm Daniel Moss, columnist at Bloomberg Opinion in New York. What actually is an emerging market? And how do the really good ones stay hot? Here to help us find out is Anu Madgavkar, a partner at McKinsey Global Institute in Mumbai. Now, Anu is really the perfect person to help steer us through this EM thicket. She's the lead author of a McKinsey report called Outperformers, High-Growth Emerging Economies and the Companies That Propel Them. Anu, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Let's start with a basic question, for which I rarely get a clear answer. What is an emerging market? I mean, it's tough to say that Mexico equals Malaysia equals Malawi. How should we be thinking about this question?
So you're right, Dan. Emerging markets, you know, there are a very large number of economies that are variously called emerging or developing, and they're all actually very different from one another. So we actually have focused on the idea of economies that are growing rapidly. So growth momentum is, you know, the most exciting feature of an emerging economy for us. So we start by looking back in time and really thinking about emerging markets as those that weren't rich to begin with, and then really asking the question of how fast are these economies narrowing the gap between themselves and the richer countries. So looking back to the mid-80s, we really look at which countries weren't high-income countries, basically defined as at the level of about $6,000 per capita of GDP at that time. And we have a universe of about 70 significantly large economies that sort of meet that criterion. And then we filter from there a set that have actually sustained very rapid per capita GDP growth over a 20 to 50 year period. So going back to the mid 60s or then starting from the early 90s. So over 20 to 50 years.
Some of these countries seem to become very buzzy for a while, like Poland or Brazil, and then fall on challenging times. What makes for a sustained, successful performance?
Not many of these have actually sustained performance over long periods of time. We found just 18 countries, of which 7 actually did it over 50 years, and another 11 did it over 20 years. So staying turbocharged for long periods of time actually requires, two or three essential elements. The most important of these is actually a sort of culture and a set of institutions that inspire and facilitate people to save and companies to invest. So the whole savings and investment, the productive use of the accumulation of capital and then the productive use of that capital typically has accounted for 60% or more of growth amongst these 18 outperformer economies that have sustained growth over long periods of time. And then the other aspect of what it takes to succeed is really institutions that have fostered competition and innovation and therefore growth in total factor productivity, and that's another roughly 25% of growth.
Well, when you start talking about total factor productivity, you're starting to lose me. I'm just a journalist. Looking, Anu, at this list of 18, the vast majority of them are located in Asia. Is there a secret sauce for that region?
The set of countries that we call long-term outperformers who've grown over about 50 years are actually all based in Asia. So here we include countries like China, South Korea, Singapore, and then Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, and so on. So there is something about a sort of regional factor, the fact that, you know, one or two large economies took off, and that seems to have created some kind of ripple effect around the region. But if we look at the more recent set of outperformers, which are the 20-year growth stories, we do find some regional diversity there. We do have India and Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos from Asia, but then you also have Central Asian countries like Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan, which have grown over a period of time on the back of very different drivers. And then you actually have Ethiopia, which is in Africa, of course, so not really close to Asia in that sense.
I'm so glad, Anu, that you mentioned Ethiopia. For those of us who came of age in the 1980s, that seems like a head-scratcher. We're used to pictures of famine and Live Aid rock concerts. What's going on with Ethiopia?
I think Ethiopia has, while it doesn't have, you know, it's not in Asia, so it doesn't have the locational advantage of being near a very large growth country or a growth cluster, but it does have at least one other really important characteristic that we see in common across the outperformers. And this is a set of very purposeful reforms that have actually opened up the market as well as created conditions conducive to investment. So Ethiopia came out of a very difficult civil war phase, but then in the 80s really started its first phase of reforms, which was very farming and agriculture oriented. In the early 2000s, they actually moved into a much more infrastructure-led wave of reforms and growth, and on the back of that have been investing in a whole set of sectors and industries across logistics, different kinds of manufacturing, including labor-intensive manufacturing and so forth. So like some of the other recent outperformers, there is work still to be done to sustain and, in fact, increase growth momentum. It's not that Ethiopia or any of the other countries can declare victory. But it's quite interesting that at least one country in the sub-Saharan Africa region has actually taken off over this period.
How important is trade to being an emerging market star?
Trade is an important aspect of, or a common sort of aspect, right, of most, if not all, of our outperformers. Simply because I think being connected to the global economy has helped them do two things. One is tap very rapidly into new sources of demand. It's not the only source of demand, so domestic demand has played a big role. Domestic consumption and investment has played a big role in the growth of most outperformers, but trade has given a very very attractive growth opportunity to many companies coming out of the emerging out of the outperformers. And then the other thing that global connectedness has done, and I would say more even more than trade, it's just being connected with the rest of the world through all kinds of global flows that include flows of information, data, financial flows, technology transfers, FDI. It's just being connected that has actually also encouraged and enabled more innovation in many of the outperformer economies. So we would think global connectedness is actually quite an important driver in addition to the capital accumulation we already talked about.
Sitting here in New York and looking at headlines about tariffs, a reasonable person might think that it was all over for trade. There is the trendy narrative about deglobalization. What did you discover when you drilled down, Anu, about the dynamic of world trade patterns?
So it's certainly true that the top line or the aggregate global trade as a share of GDP, you know, just that one number, has indeed declined ever since 2008. But as you say, right, if we drill down, what we do find is that first of all, it's really goods trade that has taken most of the hit. And most of that, if not all of it, is really the value of commodities within goods trade. So manufactured goods, particularly labor-intensive ones, exports or trade in these is still growing. services trade is still growing as a share of GDP. The second important aspect is that the corridors of trade are really shifting, and this is quite a profound shift. So if we look at what we call broadly South-South trade, which is trade amongst or between emerging economies as opposed to emerging versus rich economies. So South-South trade has actually grown as a share of, you know, global trade in goods from something like 8% to above 20% over the last 15 years or so. And that's actually quite dramatic. It's grown at, two to three times the volume of all the other corridors of trade that you can imagine.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
What role does China play in all this? Is China now importing stuff that it used to make?
There are many interesting ways, actually, in which China is reshaping not just its trade or its trade with the US, but some of these global trade corridors and opportunities. One trend that we see is that China is focusing more and more on manufacturing and export of more knowledge-intensive or R&D-intensive goods, particularly in the high-tech, electronics, computers, those kinds of spaces, and in a way, receding or ceding space in the lower value-added types of manufacturing, like textiles and leather and so on. And some of that export volume is actually moving to lower labor-cost countries like Vietnam and Bangladesh. So that's one shift. The other important shift is that we think that China as an engine of global consumption is also growing very rapidly. Emerging markets overall will drive something like 60% of global consumption out to 2030. So they are collectively important as drivers of global consumption. But China's role within that is particularly large and important. And there will be parts of that consumption that are actually going to be sourced from other lower labor cost markets as well, because domestic consumption of manufactured goods in China will pretty much continuously increase for the next 15 to 20 years.
Anu, people often talk about favorable demographics in emerging markets. By that, they usually mean young populations, or populations that are younger than in the developed world. Can you drill down a bit for us? Are some of these societies starting to age, and does that matter?
I think the demographics of emerging markets vary quite a bit, going back to your opening question about, you know, how can you speak about them in the same breath? And that's equally true of the aging profile. So you do have, in our universe, the, you know, countries in the northern and eastern part of Asia, the Central Asian countries. These definitely, are going to see and are fairly rapidly going to see aging, whereas you have South Asia and then you have Africa, where this is not going to be the case, right? But as you step back and think about the drivers of growth, we did actually find that, you know, growth in labor supply was a very, very small part of the total growth that that took place in the outperformers. So growth in productivity per worker is actually much more important. And therefore, even as economies age, there are very important drivers of productivity that still represent opportunities for unlock. In other words, you have economies that are not completely urbanized, and we know that urbanization actually lifts productivity by 2 to 3 times compared to, you know, living in rural areas. You have economies where, you know, financial access and financial inclusion is not complete. And this is true even in regions like Latin America. And we know that encouraging savings and investment actually does drive up productivity.
Many emerging markets have big conglomerates that are either state-owned or privatized to government-friendly groups. Is the sway that these corporations have a benefit for emerging markets, or is it a hassle?
We think that the outperformer economies, actually, many of them for whom, you know, we have the data and can study this feature, but we do find that one really striking feature of these economies is the role that companies of a significant size have played in driving their growth. Now, are these state-owned or are they privatized but with substantial state or quasi-state interests? Our data set essentially covered companies that are publicly listed. So whether they have a majority, you know, state shareholding or a private shareholding, as long as they're publicly listed and in some ways answerable or their data is transparent, that's the universe we looked at. But looking at such companies, we find that the outperformers actually had twice the number of large companies as other emerging economies did, that these had actually grown much faster. So they had grown from revenue to GDP of something like, you know, in the mid-20% region to the mid-60% region, which is extremely rapid growth just in terms of sheer scale and scope. And there is reason to believe that these companies are competitive.
In the US, we wrestle with the role that automation and robots will play as technology advances and as our workforce ages. When does this become a problem for emerging markets, and are they equipped to deal with it?
Automation and technology are fundamentally very powerful opportunities to drive productivity in emerging economies. And then because they do change the nature of work, they also result in a new set of work opportunities or a new type of job and employment impact, right? Now, how exactly this plays out depends to some extent on the economic cost and benefit of deploying technology. So if you think about labor cost as a proxy for that, we find that there are, I think, a large number of low labor cost emerging countries, typically those where per capita GDP is less than $5,000 or so, where even over the next, you know, 10 to 15 years, these countries would, in our opinion, have the potential to raise both employment as well as GDP from manufacturing activities. So the deployment of technology would allow them to raise value add and productivity in manufacturing, but also employment. Not all countries fall into this bucket. So there are, you know, the higher income emerging economies where this would not be the case, and where the questions around, you know, how can you actually create productive jobs in services? How can you actually reskill and redeploy people from what they're doing to the new and emerging areas within services sectors is going to be actually one of the central challenges as well as opportunities for emerging economies as you think about inclusive growth.
Anu, thank you for walking us through the world of emerging markets.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Benchmark will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, our Bloomberg app, as well as podcast destinations such as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show, so more listeners can find us. And you can follow me on Twitter at Moss_Eco. Benchmark is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.